today by talking about how proteins wiggle into the ER. And we talked about it a little bit last time, but today I want to go over the variations, which are on 12D. Now, the picture that you have there shows a bilayer. And this is assumed to be a bilayer on the outside of the ER. Now remember, the ER is three-dimensional. So there's a whole bilayer all the way around. And whatever is happening here that we're going to talk about is also happening here and all the way around. So we really have a tube, and we're pushing things in from all sides. So we've drawn a cross-section, and we're just going to focus on this little area here. And we're going to assume that there's a translocon here. Now, there is no translocon and no ribosome drawn on your picture to make it a little easier. But the assumption is there's a ribosome down here at the bottom of the translocon on the cytoplasmic side, and the protein from it is entering the ER. Now, we explained last time how you get a protein all the way into the inside of the ER. And the basic idea is that you have the membrane of the ER, and I like this sponge because it has two layers. They're not the same size, but there are two leaflets, of course, to the ER membrane. And there is a translocon forming a pore with a water-filled inside in it. You can't see that here. You have to take my word for it. So now you have a protein that has a signal peptide on its amino end. So that means it has a characteristic little hydrophobic section that binds to the signal recognition particle, that ferries the whole shebang, ribosome and a messenger and all, over to the ER. And now the protein is going to start entering the ER as a loop. And I realize that actually the one I wanted to use was this one, because in all of my cases but one, the red means the amino end. So what's going to happen is this loop, if this is the cytoplasmic side, a loop is going to form, and the little signal peptide loop is going to lodge in the membrane. Now, due to technological difficulties here, I can't just push it through, so I'm going to cheat. And I'm going to do this. Okay. So we form a little loop, except my string fell apart, so it didn't work, so I'll try again. So we're going to form a loop. I use thick string because it's easier to see, but it's also easier to fall apart. So I want to get the whole loop through for this to work properly. It doesn't seem to want to work today. This is not the way it actually happens, of course. Actually, everything slides through very nicely. So I'm going to cheat and move further up where the string hasn't split. Oh, we're not doing so well. So I'll try. No, I don't want to use a different one. So I'm going to try this again. This almost always works, but today it's being ornery. There we go. Okay, so we have now this little loop. And if I had done it properly, so the signal peptide makes one form of the loop, and it's sort of stuck in the membrane. Now, our ribosome is down here, and protein is coming out of the ribosome. And as protein comes out of the ribosome, it's going to push up the other side of the loop. Now, I see, in spite of everything, I used the wrong one. Because the one that I'm using, notice, has a hydrophobic section in the middle. So when this hydrophobic section gets up to the membrane, what's going to happen is it's going to lodge in the membrane. Now, what I intended to use, and so I'm going to do it again, is a protein that has a signal peptide on the end but has no hydrophobic section in the middle at all. Now what's going to happen is, of course, I make my loop as before. And now as the new chain grows off the ribosome, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Remember, more protein off the ribosome goes in, goes in, goes in, goes in, until the protein is finished. And now almost all of my protein is on the inside in the lumen of the ER. However, it is still lodged in the membrane by the signal peptide. Now, most of the time, what happens next is an enzyme in the ER actually cuts the sequence right here. So there is an enzyme in the ER, which is called signal peptidase, which we talked about last time. And signal peptidase cuts off the signal peptide, meaning that the enzyme recognizes a short sequence in the protein and cuts it. And now the protein folds up inside the ER, and we have a protein like we discussed last time that is entirely inside the lumen of the ER. But we know that many proteins do not completely enter the ER. They end up, for example, as either single or multiplex pass proteins lodged in the ER. Now, if this is a protein with a carboxyl and an amino end, we know that it can end up in the membrane with the amino end in the lumen or with the carboxyl end in the lumen. Either way. So we want to consider, how is that possible from this loop business? Well, we actually started to do it before one way. If you have a protein that has a signal peptide on the end, and it has a hydrophobic region in the middle, then, as we accidentally demonstrated before, the protein is going to start going through. It's going to form a loop. And then, as the peptide grows, more and more will be pushed through. And at some point, the hydrophobic section is going to lodge in the membrane. And now, although the ribosome makes more protein, it can't get across. And the rest of the protein is going to remain in the cytoplasm. And if it works this way, the carboxyl end is in the cytoplasm. This is your next case on your handout. This gives you a so-called type 1 protein. So if you look at your handout, you see that you start a little loop. The loop gets bigger and bigger. And now we've reached the stage where both hydrophobic sections are locked in the membrane. But now remember signal peptidase. So there's going to be a sequence here right after the signal peptide, which is recognized by signal peptidase. And so we're going to end up with a protein that is locked in the middle by that hydrophobic section. And the peptide, the signal peptide, is going to be degraded. And now we have a so-called type 1 protein because its amino end is in the lumen and its carboxyl end is in the cytoplasm. Now, this hydrophobic section has become the transmembrane part. And because it caused movement of the protein to stop, it's usually called a stop transfer sequence. And it becomes the transmembrane section of the protein, which now has an intraluminal domain with the amino end and an intracytoplasmic domain with the carboxyl end. But we know that that's not the only possibility. We already said that you can have a protein like that, that's a type 1, but you can also have a type 2 that has the carboxyl in the lumen, and that's the third case. How is that possible? Well, in all the cases we've discussed so far, the signal peptide is on the amino end of the protein, and once you get everything into position, you knock it off. This is not always the case. Now, in this case, this is the amino end, but this time it's blue. But now we have a little hydrophobic section, which also doubles as signal peptide, but it's in the middle of the protein. So, ribosome comes along and attaches. This is case 3. Ribosome makes protein. Where is this protein going to end up, this part? This is going to be in the cytoplasm. But now when we get to here, this is a signal peptide. So as soon as this part of the protein is made, the signal recognition particle comes along, stops translation, ferries the whole thing over to the ER. So now, this part is going to make a little loop and end up inside the membrane. Not the end, but the middle. Well, so what? If the middle starts the loop, and now the ribosome is making more protein, so more and more is pushed up. Got to pull. Be sure to pull the right end here. This is the carboxyl end, and the ribosome is going to be here, and it's going to be making more and more protein. So this is going to gradually go through until we finish making the protein. But remember, this is the part that was made last. We left the amino end behind this time in the cytoplasm, and the carboxyl end is now in the lumen. Now I have a question. Do you want to cut off the signal peptide? The whole point of this was to make a transmembrane protein with its amino in the cytoplasm and its carboxyl up here in the lumen. We want to leave it like that. So, is there going to be a recognition site here for signal peptidase? And the answer is no. Could we have cut down here? We can't, because signal peptidase is inside the lumen. So the only possibility is to cut here. So that's how you get a type 1 or a type 2. There are other ways, but this is one. Now how do you get a multipass? You get a multipass by multiple looping events. So let's try again. Here is my protein, which we're going to make into a multipass. So here's the signal peptide. I happen to put it on the amino end, but doesn't have to be there. Could be further in. So we're going to form our first loop. And when's it going to stop? When I get up to here, and this hydrophobic section is going to act like a stop transfer sequence, and I'm going to lock in the membrane. Now, signal peptidase will probably come along and cut off this amino end, leaving the amino end in the lumen. But if there had been more protein here, and this had been in the middle, then the amino end would still be in the cytoplasm. Either way. Okay, so I get this far. Now, my ribosome is down here in the cytoplasm, chugging out protein, just stays in the cytoplasm. But eventually it comes to another one of these hydrophobic sequences, and that starts the process all over again. This acts like a signal peptide and makes another loop. And so we pull up to the next hydrophobic section. So each of these little hydrophobic sections becomes a transmembrane segment. Now, depending on how many there are, whether the signal peptide's on the end or the middle, the ends of your protein can be on the outside and the cytoplasm the same, different. Now, I think I want to say one more thing about the terminology. All of these hydrophobic sections are going to lodge in the membrane and become transmembrane sections. If the chain is growing and then they get to the membrane and they stop transfer, they're called stop transfer sequences. If they start a new loop, they're usually called start transfer sequences, even though they are really both a start and a stop at the same time. So if they restart a loop, they're usually called start transfer. These are these. Now we think that these two sections are really equivalent. What determines whether you're a start or a stop, and for that matter, or a signal peptide, probably depends where you are. So if we start the loop here, this is going to act as a stop. But, and this one's going to be a start. But people have done experiments where they have recombinant proteins where they move the starts and the stops around. And it seems to depend where you are in the line, whether you're a start or a stop, they're actually equivalent. Now I have one question for you. Suppose you have a protein, which I'll call L, which normally ends up in the lumen of the ER. And then you have another protein I'll call C, and that protein ends up in the cytoplasm, in the cytosol. Now, suppose you can make recombinant genes. So if this is the sense strand, you can make one that has the left half of L and the right half of R, or you can make one that has the left half of R and the right half of L. So you make a recombinant gene, you put it into a cell, you let it make its protein, and then you ask, where does the protein end up? If these genes, recombinant genes, make protein, where will it go? Given what you now know about signal peptides and entering the ER and all that jazz, where do you think these recombinant proteins will go? So you have a couple of minutes to discuss that one, and we'll see what people think. And if you think this is obvious, if you think this is obvious and you figure it out, I have another question for you. How would you know where the protein ends up anyway? How would you follow the protein? So that's sort of question two. Question one, where does it end up? And question two, how would you know? Whose left end here, this part was coded for from the L gene, and this part from the R gene. Where will it end up? Will this end up in the lumen, the cytoplasm, or somewhere else? How many people think this protein will end up in the lumen? A few. Some. How many people think this will end up in the cytoplasm? How many people think it is too early in the morning? That's what I thought. Did you not have time to decide? Okay, keep talking. Well, let me see, are there questions? Yeah.
Is R supposed to be C?
Oh, yes. Okay. Okay, does that do it?
Yes.
Okay. See, now you have another minute. Okay. L and C are the locations of the final protein. I didn't tell you what the signals were.
No, I mean, like, on the pictures on the right?
Here?
Arrow? No, on the left.
This means that for the gene, the left half was the coding for the L, the lumen protein. And this means that the left part was coding for the cytoplasmic protein. Okay? I apologize. It wasn't clear. Yeah?
Yeah.
The cell makes it a full-length protein, but half of it corresponds to the lumen protein and half of it corresponds to the cytoplasmic protein, but which half is which is variable. Okay, let's try again. So if the left half coded for the lumen protein and the right half coded for the cytoplasmic protein, where will this end up? Lumen? Cytoplasm? Can't elsewhere? Well, there's still a lot of you that it's too early in the morning, but a reasonable number of people said it would end up in the lumen. Now, why would it end up in the lumen? Where is the signal that says, take me to the ER? Which end of the protein? It's on the amino end of the protein, which is coded for by the left end of the gene, the 5' end of the gene. So what about this protein? Where's it going to end up? Lumen? How many people think it'll be in the lumen, this one? Cytoplasm? I want to ask you if you're still asleep. So this one, why does it stay in the cytoplasm? This one will have no signal peptide. This one will have no take me to the anything signal on it, and it will stay in the cytoplasm. This one will have a signal peptide, although it belongs to the other protein, and it will stay in the cytoplasm. So now let me ask the other question. How will you find where the protein is? Does anyone have a suggestion? Someone said radioactivity. Now, that would work, except how are you going to get this protein radioactive and no other protein in the cell radioactive? So that's a little sticky. If you provide radioactive amino acids, everything will be radioactive. Yeah? What did you say? Immunofluorescence. So that means having antibody to some piece of each protein. And so if you can find out by having antibodies that are fluorescent to the right part. Now, there is something else you could do. Yeah? Well, you wouldn't want to bother with DNA probes here because you don't care about the DNA. You want to know where the protein is. But while you're doing genetic engineering, is there anything you can do? Yeah? Green fluorescent protein or some relative. When you're doing genetic engineering, in addition to having a piece from the L gene and a piece from the C gene, you could add a piece of green fluorescent, the coding part for either green fluorescent protein or yellow or red or whatever fluorescent protein. And then your protein would be fluorescent and you could find it. And the only one that would be fluorescent would be the one made from your recombinant gene. Now, one of the reasons for bringing that up is we're going to need those methods in a little bit. So I want to now move on to the question of once the protein gets into the ER or into the ER membrane, where does it go next? But before I do that, are there any questions? Yeah.
Is one of the cases when you have a single pass protein and the carboxyl end is in the lumen, is the signal peptide in the middle of the protein?
His question is, if you have a single pass protein and it has its carboxyl in the cytoplasm?
In the lumen,
okay? So if you have a protein where this is in the lumen, that's in the cytoplasm, where is the signal peptide? The signal peptide was actually in the middle and served to help entry, and we didn't cut it off. It now is the transmembrane section.
So if it's in the middle, what would you determine left or right?
Would you determine left or right? Notice we picked a protein which is entirely in the lumen. And for a protein to be entirely in the lumen, it must have a signal peptide on the amino end and have it be cut off. Yeah?
Sorry, I think I'm confused. So in the second case, the C protein is in the cytoplasm and the L protein is in the lumen and it's a transmembrane protein?
Neither of these proteins would be a transmembrane protein.
Okay.
This would be entirely in the cytosol and this would be entirely inside the lumen. But we're saying that what puts it in the lumen is a signal peptide right here. This one has no signal peptide. So if we put the signal peptide from here onto there, this protein will end up in the lumen. And those experiments are done all the time, and that's how we know that the signal peptide does it. Okay, one more.
How would you form a transmembrane protein with the first hydrophilic part on the cytoplasmic side?
How do you get the first hydrophilic part on the cytoplasmic side? You do that by having a signal peptide that is not at the end, but further in. So you would have something, if I can find the right piece of string. The signal peptide would be not here, but here. So if the signal peptide were here, then all of this part would remain in the cytoplasm, and then we would make our first loop, etc. Okay, so all the cases are diagrammed on your handout. They are described in more length in Becker. There are other ways to do it, but these are the basics. And now we want to go on to the question of, okay, so you do this stuff, you get your protein either into the ER, or for that matter, you leave it in the cytoplasm, or you end it in the membrane. So we've said that there are sort of three possibilities for your protein. If the protein's made on cytoplasmic ribosomes, either it's going to remain in the cytosol, not inside an organelle, or it's going to end up in the ER. And as we've explained, either it can be inside the lumen or it can be transmembrane, and if it's transmembrane, it can be either orientation. Now, what happens next? We actually know that the proteins in the cytosol have several choices. One of them is to go into the nucleus. One is to stay in the cytosol. And another one is to go into the organelles of the that are not part of the endomembrane system, such as peroxisomes and mitochondria and chloroplasts. And how that works, we're going to talk about next time. We're not going to talk about that today. What we want to talk about today is what happens to these proteins. Where do they go from here? And most of them go from the ER by the formation of a vesicle that buds off from the ER. They go to the Golgi. And we've said several times that the Golgi is a series of flattened sacs, sort of like a pita. I have another model here, something like this. And stuff moves through one sac at a time and comes out the other end. Exactly how it does this is a very interesting question to which we will return. But we know that material enters the side closest to the ER, which is called the cis side, and it exits the trans side. And when material and all this things pass from one compartment to another by the formation of vesicles. And we'll look at that more carefully in a bit. And now vesicles, the trans part of the Golgi, vesicles form off it. And these vesicles then carry proteins, which are either in the membrane or inside. And today I want to concentrate on the vesicles that have protein inside. Now, we already said that some of these actually contain the acid hydrolases that are going to be found in lysosomes and degrade other macromolecules. So some of these are going to go to lysosomes. We're going to explain later today how that happens. Now, of these two, maybe I should put in a third, there should be another class of vesicles that go to other parts of the endomembrane system. And to some extent, what this illustrates is at the end of the Golgi, you have a sorting out system. As we'll see for lysosomes, you need another step. But different parts of the Golgi are thought to bud off different vesicles going to different places. And the two that are remaining ones are going to go to the plasma membrane, fuse with the plasma membrane, and deliver their contents to the outside of the cell. So both of these are going to deliver secreted proteins. But they're usually divided into two classes. One is called a default vesicle. And the process is sometimes called constitutive secretion. Because the basic idea is that default vesicles, having no other instructions, simply go to the plasma membrane, fuse with the plasma membrane, and release their contents. They are not in any way speeded up or slowed down by external conditions. They just do it all the time. And we should mention that in general, when you have... let me come back to the other case. So they just do it constantly. But the other class of vesicle engages in what is called regulated secretion. They don't just automatically go to the plasma membrane and fuse with it. They go near the plasma membrane and they wait. And only in response to a signal does that vesicle fuse with the plasma membrane and deliver the goods. And these are usually called secretory vesicles. So this is regulated secretion and constitutive. An example of regulated secretion is the release of insulin, or hormone. It is only released in response to signals from the outside of the cell that it is proper to do so. Now, I should just mention that usually fusion of a secretory vesicle with the plasma membrane and the release of the contents, and it's also true for neurotransmitter vesicles, is usually caused by a spike in calcium. It's usually kept very low in the cell, and when it's higher, it promotes the fusion of membranes. So what we're saying is that whatever the signal from the outside is, it usually leads to a calcium spike inside the cell that causes fusion of membranes and release of the contents of the secretory vesicle. So the big picture is that things go to the ER, from the ER to the Golgi, through the Golgi, and then from the Golgi into a vesicle and to sort it wherever they're supposed to go. And what I want to do now is I want to go back and look more closely at what happens in and around the ER, what happens in and around the Golgi, and then how do enzymes get to lysosomes. So we want to start, so to speak, back to the ER. Now, we keep drawing pictures of proteins going into the ER and folding up. But proteins don't... So folding is one of the big things that happens in the ER. Proteins don't normally fold all by themselves. They can fold in dilute solution. We know this from the famous Anfinsen experiment. And shape into which they are going to fold is embedded in their amino acid sequence. However, in a very crowded cell, they usually need some help in order to achieve that final sequence, and that is done by having proteins that are called chaperones or chaperonins. Every time a protein folds or unfolds, a chaperone is involved. Now, there are two major types of chaperones that are known as HSP60 and HSP70. These are really families of proteins. 60 and 70 refers to their relative molecular weights of 60,000 and 70,000. And these are quite different in that this one forms a sort of barrel-like structure from multiple subunits. And the protein then goes inside the barrel where it won't bump into anything else and is allowed to fold. HSP70s, on the other hand, stick to hydrophobic regions and allow the protein to fold properly. And we're not going to go into the details of this, and besides, I think Dr. Chazen may have talked about it. Now, why are these things called HSP? Because they were discovered because they protect against heat shock. So they are named heat shock proteins, because when you shock a cell or raise its temperature, it makes a lot of these proteins in order to help its proteins refold and recover. Now, different chaperones are found in different parts of the cell, and the one that is found largely in the in the ER, the major one in the ER is called BIP, for reason, by something. I don't know what it stands for. So proteins have to fold up in order to take on their proper shape and do their proper job. Now, if they don't fold properly, they're usually degraded. And we'll get to that in a minute. But first I want to consider what other things happen to a protein when it's inside the ER. Well, we've already talked about glycosylation, the addition of sugars. And glycosylation starts in the ER and finishes up in the Golgi. So the enzymes of glycosylation are either inside the ER lumen or inside part of the Golgi. Now, there are two kinds of glycosylation, which are called N and O. Because the sugars are added to either a nitrogen or an oxygen in the side chain of an amino acid. So in the case of N glycosylation, they're always added to the amid of asparagine. Because the side chain of asparagine ends like this, which is an amid, and the sugars are added to this nitrogen. In the case of O-glycosylation, the sugars are added to the side chains of serine and threonine, both of which have hydroxyls, or OHs. Now, what happens is that the N-glycosylation starts in the ER, but it finishes up in the Golgi, and all the O-glycosylation is in the Golgi tube. So I just put these two for comparison, but we have to wait on O-glycosylation until we get to the Golgi. Now, another thing that happens is, what about the formation of disulfide bonds? These form spontaneously in dilute solution, but in a cell environment, enzymes are needed to connect two cysteines and form a disulfide bond. And the enzymes that do that are also inside the ER. Now, proteins all over contain cysteine, which has an SH side group. But two SHs are only connected to make an SS if the appropriate enzyme is available. Now, there's one other thing that's important. Protein has to fold, has to have some sugars added usually. If it has disulfides, they have to be made. And there's something else that usually happens inside to many, but not all, proteins. And that is, remember, signal peptidase resides inside the ER. So if the SP is going to be removed, if it's going to be removed, it happens inside the ER. And that's going to depend, if you have a signal peptide, on the sequence next to it. If this sequence is the substrate for signal peptidase, then that chain will be cleaved. If there's a different sequence here, it will not. Now, some proteins remain in the ER. But most proteins, even those destined to live out most of their lives in the ER, go further down the road to the end of the Golgi and then are shipped back to wherever they're supposed to go, including the ER. So relatively few proteins stay in the ER, and most of them move on to the Golgi. But before we say that, we have to remember this business of what happens if a protein does not fold properly. If cells misfold or they get old and worn out, they have to be degraded. And generally, they are not degraded in lysosomes. Most of the things that get degraded in lysosomes come from the outside of the cell. But things on the inside of the cell, most of them that are misfolded or old or worn out, basically go to a structure in the cytoplasm, which is called the proteasome. This comes from protease, meaning enzyme that breaks down proteins. But this is a very large structure with many parts, which is why it's called a proteasome. So it's a some, like a ribosome or a spliceosome. It doesn't have any RNA in it, but it's a large complex machine, like those. And it's usually thought of as being barrel-shaped. Proteins that are misfolded in the ER are reverse translocated back out of the ER into the cytoplasm. The exact mechanism is not clear. It might be reversed through the translocon, might be something else. But proteins that are misfolded, that don't get shipped back out of the ER, and then they get tagged to be eaten by the proteasome. And the way you tag a protein so that it will fit into and be degraded by a proteasome is to add a small protein called ubiquitin. Now, this comes from ubiquitous. This protein was found everywhere, but nobody knew what it was for. And that's how it got this name. It's a relatively small protein. So the misfolded protein gets a bunch of ubiquitins added to it. And this requires a series of enzymes, which we won't discuss. And once a protein gets a bunch of U's on it, either because it was misfolded or old or whatever, this says, take me to a proteasome and eat me. This is the signal that will send it to the proteasome. It will go into the barrel and it will be degraded. Now, we see what goes into a proteasome, what comes out. Well, the protein is broken up not to amino acids, but to short pieces, and the ubiquitins are released. So you get back your ubiquitin, you can then add to another target, mark it for degradation, and use it over again, and then you get pieces. These can then be degraded further to amino acids, and the amino acids can be recycled. But there's another significance to these pieces. Because of the proteasome, it means that any cell contains pieces of every protein that it is making. Whether they were in the ER, whether it was in the cytoplasm, they're going to be little bits of whatever protein it's making in the cell. It turns out that these proteins are important in a phenomenon of the immune system called immune surveillance. If your cells are infected by a virus and making virus protein, they are recognized by the immune system and destroyed. How does your body know what proteins are being made inside the cell? How does it know the cell's infected? Because the cell makes some viral protein, some of that viral protein gets into the proteasomes, and you have all those little pieces. And now, all the little pieces of whatever the cell is making get stuck to another protein and put back on the surface. We'll discuss how that happens later. But the point is that a surface of a cell has on it little pieces of whatever it's making. If those are normal proteins, the immune system ignores it. If those are abnormal proteins, then the immune system destroys that cell. So these pieces are used to tell the immune system what proteins the cell is making. Yeah?
So what's going on with the autoimmune reaction?
Autoimmune reactions are where the immune system gets confused and it doesn't distinguish between self protein and foreign protein. Exactly why is not entirely clear.
How does the cell know if a protein
has been misfolded? How does a cell know if a protein is misfolded? That is a very good question, which I don't know all of the answer to. Part of the answer probably is if it has hydrophobic sequences extending on the outside, which it is not supposed to do. If it is a soluble protein, the hydrophobic part should be buried. Yeah?
How does the immune system know that it's a...
How does the immune system know it's foreign?
Yeah.
Stay tuned. Yeah?
How long are the pieces?
How long are the pieces? I'm not sure, but I think they're like 12, 20. Yeah, amino acids.
It sounds like the lysosome then takes over after the proteasome.
Does the lysosome take over after the proteasome? No, it does not. The lysosome will only digest things that are surrounded by a membrane.
which usually means endocytic vesicles that came in by receptor-mediated endocytosis fused with a endosome, etc. There are cases where pieces of the cell can be enveloped in a membrane of the cell inside, and the cell digests that piece in a lysosome. There are other proteases in cells which will cut up these small pieces. Yeah.
So the ubiquitous tags, when you say that they are used to tell the cell what it's making, are you saying that only because they're tagged or because there's some signal also involved?
No, the ubiquitin is used to tag proteins for degradation. When the protein is broken down, the ubiquitin is knocked off. So what ends up on the outside of the cell are these pieces, not the ubiquitin.
Ubiquitin is just for tagging.
Ubiquitin is only for sending. It allows the proteasome to bind to the protein and essentially take it in and degrade it. Okay. Now, before we leave the ER, there's just one more piece we have to add. That if you consider our picture of the ER here, so this is, of course, a membrane. This is a membrane. We've talked about proteins that are inside, and we've talked about transmembrane proteins. Some of the transmembrane proteins are enzymes whose enzymatic domain is in the cytoplasm. But because of one or more hydrophobic sections, they are anchored or locked into the membrane. Now, these enzymes do their thing in the cytoplasm, but the product often, and sometimes the product remains in the cytoplasm, sometimes the product is a lipid which is inserted into the membrane, as we explained earlier. These enzymes in animal cells are largely involved with lipid synthesis and with detoxifications, but some enzymes do other things as well. But I just wanted to mention that there's a class of enzymes like this associated with the ER. Now, I want to leave the ER and move on to the Golgi. Now, we've discussed several times that the way things get from the ER to the Golgi is that vesicles bud off the ER, carrying protein either inside or in the membrane. These are coated vesicles, but the coats are not made of clathrin. They're made of different proteins. And then these vesicles fuse with the ER and deliver their contents, both membrane and material, to the Golgi. So we really want to look at now 13A, which has a diagram of the Golgi. It actually has two, but we're just going to start with the left one. So if the ER is down here, we're assuming that a vesicle forms from the ER and goes to the Golgi. So this is the so-called cis or forming side of the Golgi, and this is the trans or budding or maturing face of the Golgi. Now, there are two items shown on this handout. This little wiggle here is meant to be a protein which is being passed on through the Golgi. So this protein, we know, is found first in what is called the cis part of the Golgi, of course, then in the middle part, known as the medial, and then in the trans. So it's clear that this newly made protein progresses through the Golgi from the cis side to the trans. Exactly how it does that remains to be seen, as we will explain. Now, there are vesicles associated here with the Golgi, but what they are carrying and which way they are going is debatable, and we'll come back to it. But we know that overall, proteins move through, and then vesicles bud off carrying them. Now, there aren't only three. I've just drawn three here because there are three kinds. There are multiple sacs. Each of these is a sac or a cisterna. I think that's the singular. And the whole thing is called a stack. And a stack can have 8 or 10 of these sacs. And this is, remember, a cross-section. Each of the sacs is sort of like a Mediterranean pita, and it would be more in keeping with the theme of this class to use bread, but you wouldn't be able to see what's inside. So here you can sort of see that they actually each have material, room for material inside, and what you're looking at there is a cross-section of this stack. Now, in addition to the protein, which is sometimes called cargo, which is being moved along here, there are enzymes in the Golgi that carry out modifications. For example, we know that N-glycosylation is finished in the Golgi, and O-glycosylation occurs in the Golgi. And there are characteristic enzymes that do modifications of proteins. And these enzymes are different in each part of the Golgi. So this is meant to be a modifying enzyme, like one that adds sugars, for example, or rearranges sugar. And I've drawn different ones in each compartment of the Golgi. Now, these enzymes are characteristic. That is, the cis part of the Golgi has a certain set of enzymes, the medial has a different, and the trans has another. And these characteristic enzymes, that when you find them, you know you found which part of the Golgi you found, are called marker enzymes. Marker enzymes are known for just about every organelle or subcompartment of the cell. For example, acid hydrolases are marker enzymes for lysosomes, of which the most famous is acid phosphatase. Catalase is a marker enzyme for peroxisomes. These are enzymes that are characteristic of this particular organelle. Now, how would you find a marker enzyme? How would you know where a particular enzyme is in the cell? You've already told me you can use immunofluorescence. If you had a recombinant gene for the enzyme, you could use the fluorescence of the enzyme. And the other thing, since these are enzymes, you can use their enzymatic ability. Remember, in situ enzyme assays, you can provide substrate and see, does it become part product here, or here, or here? So using the various techniques that we've talked about, you can locate marker enzymes, which allows you to locate where certain organelles are and vice versa. So, before we go any further, I just want to say what happens inside the Golgi, and then we'll consider how you move things around. Now, we've already said that what happens in the ER, what's going to happen in the Golgi, is we're going to finish this glycosylation business. So we're going to finish N-glycosylation and do O-glycosylation. Some of this involves just simply adding sugars. Some of it involves moving things around. If you're interested in the enzymatic details, you can look them up, but we're not going to go into them. Now, another thing that happens is you may remember that some secreted materials are these proteoglycans. Proteoglycans are a small amount of protein associated with long repeating sugar chains. And those long repeating sugar chains are glycosaminoglycans, are made in the Golgi. So what we're saying is glycosaminoglycans, which are the long sugars, are put together and, for that matter, attached to their protein in the Golgi. Now, there are a bunch of these modifications that occur in the Golgi, and then one of the really important things which seems to happen is at the trans side of the Golgi,
there appears to be a lot of sorting. That is, that proteins don't randomly butt off any old part of the Golgi. It appears that proteins destined for a particular thing, like secreted, default vesicles versus secretory vesicles, proteins destined for lysosomes. It's thought that different proteins are grabbed or assembled at different parts of the Golgi, and therefore bud off in different vesicles. Now, each vesicle will contain many proteins, but all of them are destined for the same place. So sorting is a major function of the Golgi, of the trans part, which is sometimes called the trans-Golgi network, or the TGN. Because if you look here in the cell, you see a whole bunch of vesicles and tubes and stuff coming off the end of the Golgi. So that's sometimes called the trans-Golgi network. Now, one of the big questions about the Golgi is how do materials move through the Golgi? And that's why you have two pictures on your handout to illustrate the two possibilities. Everybody agrees that the cargo enters on this side, on the cis, and exits on the trans, and that the cargo gets modified in the middle. Everybody also agrees that one set of characteristic enzymes is found in the cis, a different in the medial, a different in the trans. But the question that remains is, how do you move stuff from one compartment to the next? And there are two basic models that are shown on your handout. And they all involve these vesicles. The question is, what's in the vesicles and which way are they going? And you notice that in the so-called stationary model, the vesicles are going from cis to trans. And in the so-called maturation model or progression model, they're going from trans to cis. This direction is called retrograde, because relative to what the cargo is doing, it's going the other way. Forward, on the other hand, is called anterograde, just meaning forward. Now, if we look at this model, which is the stationary, meaning the sacs are stationary, their characteristic enzymes stay with them, but the cargo has to be moved. So the newly made protein gets modified here, and then it gets moved up, and then it gets moved up. So that would be in this model, that what would happen is a vesicle would come from the ER, and it would fuse with the bottom sac, delivering the goods. Inside there, it would get modified by enzymes, and then a vesicle carrying the modified protein would butt off and fuse with the next sac. Then inside that sac, you do the next set of modifications, then the vesicle would butt off and fuse with the next. So in this model, the sacs stay put, the vesicles move forward, carrying the cargo. Now, in the other model, the idea is a little different. The idea is that each sac gradually changes properties and becomes the next one. But if that's going to happen, then you have to pick up the enzymes for modification and send them back where they came from. So the idea in that one is that here is your stack. I'm going to make it a little shorter, I think, to make it a little clearer. And you have a cis, a medial, and a trans. So what happens is multiple vesicles from the ER come, and they make a new stack, a new sac. Now, the sac that's on the far end, it comes apart into vesicles going to different parts of the cell. But what about the modifying enzymes that were in here? They go into the vesicles. The vesicles capture those enzymes and take them back to here. So that sac is gone, but now we have a new cis, a new medial, and a new trans. So what used to be the enzymes that used to be in the old trans went into here. The enzymes that used to be in the old medial went into here. And the enzymes that used to be in the old cis went into here. So in this model, the vesicles are moving retrograde, and they're retrieving the modifying enzymes. But They aren't carrying, they're carrying modifying enzymes instead of cargo. Now, there is evidence for both of these. We know that these vesicles can butt off one sac and fuse with another. And we even know that in a cell that has two, in an artificial situation where there are two stacks, vesicles from this stack can fuse with that one. But it's not clear which way the vessels go or whether there is some hybrid model and some vesicles go this way and some vesicles go that way. It's also been suggested that it may vary depending on the cell and what the cargo is. If the cargo is very big, then the maturation model makes more sense. But if the cargo is small, then shuttling with the vesicles seems to make more sense rather than having to keep grabbing your enzymes back. So that one is still sort of up in the air. And there's a problem in your problem book which deals with the question of how does it work and what you would expect from experiments from each model. So let me ask if there are questions about the Golgi before we consider the issue of lysosomes. Yeah?
I'm sorry, can you run over real quick over the maturation model?
Well, the maturation model, which I deliberately didn't draw, which is drawn for you.
Yes.
What?
Yes, you don't have to draw it, but...
You mean with saying how it works. Okay, so here would be, let's say, 3. And then vesicles from the ER would form a new sac. And then at the maturing end, or the trans end, this would come apart into vesicles, each carrying cargo, but the enzymes that used to be in here would go into the vesicles and they would fuse with here.
And the vesicles from that one will go...
And the vesicles from this one would go to here, with the tear the enzymes back one. The enzymes are always, the modifying enzymes are always being carried back one in that model. Other questions? Yeah.
Does the maturation model require significantly more input of energy?
Does the maturation model require significantly more input of energy? I don't know the answer to that one. Yeah?
Is the number of sacs in each like trans meiosis, is it fixed?
Is the number of sacs fixed? I think in any one Golgi apparatus in a cell which is in one particular state, yes. But if a cell changes from doing not very much secretion to doing a lot of secretion, there might be an increase in the number of sacs. Okay. So now we get to the lysosome question. How do you get enzymes to lysosomes? And that's on your last handout on B. Now we know that the enzymes, the acid hydrolases, which are going to end up in lysosomes, get there from the ER. And most of the material that's going to be degraded by lysosomes comes from receptor-mediated endocytosis from outside of the cell, although a little comes from vesicles inside. So we have to put together a vesicle from the ER containing hydrolases and a vesicle from RME containing what you want to chew up, the substrate, and put them together. Now, this involves endosomes. And in this discussion, we're not distinguishing early and late endosomes, primary and secondary lysosomes, any of that. We're just talking about the general picture. And one of the reasons we're so interested in it is we think that other proteins might be sorted in a similar way, and because there are a bunch of diseases associated with defects in this process. So what is supposed to happen is you have a cell coming from the ER, and I've put two proteins in it. The assumption is this one is going to be secreted. It's actually going to be constitutive secretion. It's going to go into a fault vesicle. And this one is going to go to a lysosome. So they're in a vesicle that buds off the ER. So one, we get them from the ER. And now that vesicle fuses with the Golgi. It would fuse with the foremost sac or form the foremost sac on the cis side. And now these two are inside the Golgi. Now, I'm going to leave out 3 for a minute. I'll put it in, but we know that by the time you get to the trans Golgi,
there are receptors for what is called mannose-6-phosphate, or M6P. This is a sugar which is only found on proteins that are destined to go to lysosomes. And it is formed, not strictly speaking, by the addition of mannose-6-phosphate, but by the rearrangement of other pre-existing sugars. But, so any enzyme that has the mannose-6-phosphate on it, that enzyme is going to be trapped in one part of the Golgi by the mannose-6-phosphate receptors. Now, there's not going to be any mannose-6-phosphate on the enzyme that's going, or protein that's going to be secreted. Only proteins destined for lysosomes get mannose-6-phosphate. So now, remember we said vesicles bud off from different parts of the Golgi. So the proteins that are going to be secreted, a vesicle containing them buds off one part of the Golgi, and the vesicles that are going to go carry hydrolases bud off another part. So this is going to go as in 11, well, this is 11 actually, and now in 12, this is just going to go fuse with the plasma membrane and deliver the goods. But the enzyme that had the mannose-6-phosphate on it is going to be trapped by the mannose-6-phosphate receptors and end up in a separate vesicle and ultimately go to a lysosome. How do we know this? Mannose-6-phosphate business. We know that there is a disease called eye cell disease, and the I stands for inclusion, because people who have this disease have inclusions. They have little vesicles full of junk in them. And the reason for that is they're not able to add mannose-6-phosphate. They have a block here. What determines if you add mannose-6-phosphate? If a protein is going to go to a lysosome, how does the cell know? It's embedded in the primary sequence or the three-dimensional shape on a patch. It's actually embedded in the structure of the protein itself. The protein itself has some little section which is recognized by the appropriate enzyme. So this little protein has a stretch of amino acids. The secreted protein doesn't. So the enzyme adds mannose-6-phosphate onto the enzyme that's supposed to go to a lysosome, but not on the end to the enzyme that's supposed to be secreted. Now this is what normally happens. But in people who have eye cell disease, this enzyme is missing. Now if that enzyme is missing, what's going to happen? In a way, you can look at the bottom, if you want, at the bottom of the picture, where we have blow-up of our Golgi sac. And you notice we have here not just the secreted protein and not just one enzyme that's supposed to go to lysosomes, but we have several. So we have here at least three different enzymes that are supposed to go to lysosomes. So what is supposed to happen is we are supposed to add mannose-6-phosphate to all the circles, to all the squares, to all the little flowery ones, but not to the secreted protein. That's what's supposed to happen. But if this enzyme is missing, this doesn't happen. So, what are these proteins going to do? Are they going to combine with mannose-6-phosphate receptors? No way. In fact, since they have no address, they have nothing, no marker, they just go into default vesicles and are released to the outside of the cell. So in eye cell disease, a whole bunch of lysosomal enzymes follow this pathway, and in eye cell disease, they end up outside the cell. So the cell does not have enzymes to chew up its macromolecules, and it's left with these inclusions, which are essentially lysosomes with substrate and no enzyme to chew them. And The enzymes are released to the outside of the cell, to the extracellular matrix, where they chew up things they're not supposed to. So this disease is bad news. Fortunately, it is very rare. Now, in eye cell disease, not every enzyme and not every tissue has a problem. So we know that mannose-6-phosphate receptors are not involved in all lysosomal enzymes, although they are involved in most. And in some tissues, the proteins get to lysosomes, they must, in a different way. Because even in eye cell disease, they end up where they're supposed to be. But in many tissues, then, we know that what happens, and we're considering this the standard, that the enzyme that's going to go to a lysosome gets mannose-6-phosphate added to it, it binds to a receptor, and now those receptors, there's a vesicle with the enzyme for a lysosome with mannose-6-phosphate and a receptor. And now if you look, these are going to go in step 7, and they're going to fuse with endosomes. Remember endosomes? If something comes in from the outside by RME, it ends up in an endosome. And in endosomes, you usually sort receptors and ligands. That's what happens. So we separate here the receptor and the ligand. Now, the 8A and 8B here match the numbers on the RME handout. Because what's going to happen to is you're going to get now vesicles from this side carrying the receptor and vesicles from this side carrying the enzyme. This is going to go infuse with a lysosome or form a new lysosome. But what's this receptor supposed to do? It is actually, this vesicle is going to go back and fuse with the Golgi and do it again. Now, this is the normal state of affairs. Now, if a person has eye cell disease, it turns out you can't do much about it. But if they have other lysosomal storage diseases, you can, and let me explain that briefly. That if you look at the bottom picture, what you see is supposed to happen is the protein designed for secretion, its vesicle goes to the plasma membrane, and we release the protein. Now, what happens, apparently, is a small number of modified enzymes accidentally go in those vesicles. So a small number are in there, and a little bit then, in a normal person, of the enzyme that is supposed to be in the lysosomes ends up outside. Whether this is normal and the way some enzymes get to lysosomes, we don't know. But this is called the scavenger pathway, because we're going to get them. Because remember now that when we got to an endosome, the receptor was supposed to go back to the Golgi, and the enzyme was supposed to go to a lysosome. Well, just as we can misdirect an enzyme, we can misdirect sometimes the receptor. So some of the vesicles containing the receptor actually end up fusing with the plasma membrane and giving you some receptor on the outside. These two misdirections come together and save the enzyme because this is a receptor for mannose-6-phosphate. This is an escaped enzyme with mannose-6-phosphate. They get it together and you get regular receptor-mediated endocytosis. So where will it end up? Normally, something that comes in by receptor-mediated endocytosis goes to an endosome and maybe a lysosome. Oy vey, it gets degraded. But this is like the tar baby. Throw me in the briar patch. Where is this enzyme supposed to be? In a lysosome. Now, the reason this is important is it's been used to treat one of the lysosomal storage diseases. In lysosomal storage diseases, one of these enzymes is defective. Not the whole shebang, but one. So what can you do? If you add that enzyme with mannose-6-phosphate on it to the outside, the cells will take it up by the so-called scavenger pathway. And this technique is used to treat Gaucher's disease, one of the most well-known lysosomal storage diseases. The enzyme is obtained from other sources. The enzyme is purified. Mannose-6-phosphate is added to it. I think the enzyme is made by genetic recombination methods. And then the enzyme is supplied to the people who lack this enzyme. They take it in by the scavenger pathway and send it to a lysosome where it belongs. You can't do this in eye cell disease because you would have to add all of the lysosomal enzymes. And it costs about $50,000 a year to add one. And the reason for that is that the technology for adding the mannose is difficult and expensive. Making the enzyme is not, but adding the mannose. So what we will do next time is perhaps we will spend just a few minutes wrapping this up or answer questions about it, and then we will go on to the question of what happens with peroxisomes in mitochondria, and that part will not be on the next exam.